This is side four of Macular Degeneration, written by Lilas G. Mauck, M.D., and Marja Mauck, Ph.D. Continuing on page 153, your volunteer reader for this section is Lynn Schmaltz. Part 2, Experiencing AMD. Chapter 5. I am not blind. The shock of AMD. I am not blind. Do not tell me that I am blind. I refuse to be blind. I hate that word. A quote from Grace Olson. When I first met Grace Olson, she was wearing a blue wool dress with pearl buttons. She had her hair in a pretty blonde bob, and she held her chin up. At 82, she looked not a day over 70, and she was fierce. She eyed me unapologetically and observed that she had been to two other ophthalmologists since she had been diagnosed with macular degeneration, including her retinal specialist, and none of them had much to say. "My son thinks I should go to the School for the Blind in Kalamazoo," she said evenly. "But I am not blind. Do not tell me that I am blind. I refuse to be blind. I hate that word." No, I agreed. She was not blind, and she would not go blind for macular degeneration. But with 20/200 acuity in both eyes, she did have low vision. "You have no idea what this is like," Grace continued, her voice becoming softer. "It's such a shock. You cannot understand unless it happens to you." And then she quietly began to cry. "You have no idea what this is like." Grace was right. I have no idea what it's like to have macular degeneration. I am already past 60, though my father has advanced macular degeneration and I have his light blue eyes. Since those are all risk factors, I may know in a few years. But talking right now with Grace, I could not tell her that I really understood. Listening and imagining are not the same as living. This is one of the toughest things facing anyone with macular degeneration. It's an experience that's very hard to convey. Macula what? Until the late 1990s, virtually no one had heard of age-related macular degeneration. When we wrote the first edition of this book, there were no other books on the topic and few articles in the newspapers. Of course, ophthalmologists knew it existed, but nobody was talking about it at the dinner table. Those diagnosed with AMD found themselves shocked and disoriented. "Macaroni what?" they'd say, or "immaculate what?" or "degeneration what?" Then there was Zelda Grant, who called it the Macarena after the Latin American dance tune popular in the 1996s. Zelda, like most everybody else who had lost vision from AMD, found her family, friends, and neighbors totally confused. "What is a macular?" everyone wondered. As Zelda said, "It's hard to have something that changes your whole life and no one gets it. They can't even say its name." Today, the name isn't any easier to pronounce, but there is much more attention to macular degeneration in the media and at research centers around the country and the world than there was as recently as 1998. There has literally been an explosion of new research on macular degeneration in the medical community. Researchers in the Netherlands, Germany, and Japan have been in the forefront of finding new treatments for AMD in the last 4 years, along with hundreds of leading physicians and scientists at dozens of universities and hospitals here in the United States. Up to 700,000 Americans develop early-stage AMD every year, and 200,000 lose their central vision to it annually. Macular degeneration affects the citizens of every European country and is now appearing in Asia and South America as well. So the race is on to stop this condition and to develop technologies that restore lost sight. We all know its name now, and we're going to lick it. It's hard to see if it isn't happening to you. We usually associate vision loss with looking different. We expect people with vision loss to be blind, and blind people to have obviously damaged or unfocused eyes. But if you have macular degeneration, you won't look any different to your neighbors, friends, or family. You make proper eye contact with people, just like you always have, so they are unlikely to realize that you can't see them clearly. In familiar surroundings, you probably don't appear to be any less competent or confident than you did 10 years ago. You may also be able to do much of what you did before macular degeneration, although it may take 2 to 3 times longer. I used to be able to change a doorknob in 10 minutes, Joe Toscano reported. Now I can still do it, but it takes over an hour for a doorknob. I'm always worried about how much worse it will get, but the neighbors have no idea. To them, I look and act just like the same old Joe. Because you look and act so much like you always have, even best friends and spouses may find it difficult to remember what you can and can't see. It's amazing how easily even the people closest to me forget, Dolly Kowalski told me. My friend Maria and I have dinner together almost every night. Every week we went to an Italian restaurant and Maria says in a disappointed voice, Dolly, you haven't said anything about my new necklace. I just said, have you lost your mind? I can't see that necklace. I didn't even know you were wearing one. Maria was very quiet. So I said, pass the dates, please. Then she said gently, they're not dates, Dolly. They're olives. So I winked at her. I figured they were olives. But honestly, she knows I can't recognize people when they walk into the room. What in the world would possess her to think I could see a little pearl necklace? So what can you see? To say you have macular degeneration is to say that your central vision is affected, but it doesn't say how much it is affected. You may have 20/40 visual acuity or 20/600 or anything in between. See Chapter 1 for an explanation of visual acuity measurements. To say you have macular degeneration also doesn't say how your vision is affected, and how turns out to matter a great deal. AMD reduces central vision, but it also affects contrast sensitivity, glare sensitivity, and depth perception. All of these factors influence your overall experience of seeing. It's helpful to understand these factors and be aware of what you can and can't see. It's also very helpful for your friends and family to understand your experience of seeing. But remember that to say that you have macular degeneration or to say you have a certain visual acuity doesn't say much about what you can or can't do with your vision. It's true that if you have 20/200 vision, you aren't likely to qualify for a driver's license. But driver's licenses are legally regulated according to visual acuity. Most activities in life are not. Don't make the leap between being aware of your vision and labeling yourself with limitations. Contrast sensitivity. Low contrast sensitivity explains much of what seems peculiar about vision affected by AMD. For example, most people find it difficult to understand or explain why they can see a 2-inch letter in a newspaper headline, but they can't recognize their own grandchildren's faces. Most of their relatives find this confusing too. Maria fell right into this divide when she went to dinner with Dolly and fished for a compliment on the necklace. Dolly could see the olives on the table, after all, so why couldn't she see Maria's necklace? The answer is that Dolly has low contrast sensitivity. Macular degeneration may decrease contrast sensitivity because it affects the ability of the cone cells to tell similar colors or shades apart. As a result, many people with macular degeneration find it difficult to distinguish between navy blue and brown, or pastel pink and pastel orange. In fact, any object that isn't in sharp contrast to its background may be difficult to see. Black-white contrast combinations are always the best. That's why Dolly can see black olives on a white plate. They have an excellent contrast and are therefore much easier to see than a pearl necklace against a white sweater, regardless of the size of the necklace. Human faces are the worst. They have terrible contrast. No matter what color your skin may be, it's probably all the same color, so the contours of your features blend together. "I have four beautiful little children," Dolly Kowalski said. "They all look equally beautiful to me. In fact, they all look the same. When they visit me, we play the Who's Kissing Grandma Now game. My daughter says, how can they look alike? They have such different features. But what's a nose or a chin when it's the same color as a forehead? If we all had either extremely light or extremely dark skin, neon orange eyes and lips, and a contrasting color nose, we'd be much more visible. Until that happens, macular degeneration may make it easier to see a 2-inch-high black letter standing against white paper than to see a grandchild's nose. They're all my favorites, Dolly said. I tell them, Grandma can't see your pretty smiles, so you have to laugh out loud when you're happy. So they fall all over themselves, guffawing. My daughter always comes running in and tries to quiet the ruckus. Glare sensitivity. Glare sensitivity also affects many people with macular degeneration. Joe Toscano's experience is typical. I'm actually not too bothered by contrast, especially since Inez matches up my clothes, Joe said, flipping a fluorescent light switch in his kitchen. But look, I can hardly open my eyes with this glare. When I'm in someone else's house, I find it difficult to see as much as I usually can if they have fluorescent lighting or if the room is flooded with sunlight. I carry a pair of light yellow noir sunglasses to cut the glare indoors. My old friend Tony says to me, "Hey, Joe, what are you doing wearing those goggles inside?" I say, "Hey, Tony, do you want to play cards or not?" "No goggles, no cards." "You should wear them, too. They'd make you look better." Tony just smiles. "We've been giving each other a hard time for 70 years. We met in grade school. How about that?" Depth perception. Buddy Burmeister doesn't notice glare as much as Joe, but does have poor depth perception. Poor depth perception may occur when one eye is more affected by AMD than the other, throwing the two out of sync. It may also result from low contrast sensitivity. Contrast sensitivity enhances our depth perception because we use variations in shades and sharp lines to perceive three-dimensional objects. Have you ever seen a coin at the bottom of a pool, dived for it, and found that it's not where you expected it to be? That's macular degeneration for me, Buddy Burmeister said. It's like living with permanent pool vision. I can't tell you how many times I've reached for a soda can and it's not exactly where I think it is. It's such a difficult experience to convey it to anyone else. It's just a difficult experience, period. I'm not even used to it yet. One of the most frustrating consequences of poor depth perception is that it may make walking in unfamiliar places more precarious. Since walking is important for transportation and exercise, if you have poor depth perception, consider using a walking cane for stability or walk with a friend. Explore other forms of physical activity and exercise, such as riding a stationary bicycle, swimming, pool running, weightlifting, gentle stretching classes, or relaxation yoga. Above all, try not to let poor depth perception contribute to isolation and lower activity levels. the shock of discovering AMD. For some people, macular degeneration comes on gradually, as it did for Sam Weinberg, whose dry AMD progressed very slowly for 15 years. For others, like Zelda Grant, macular degeneration comes in waves. Initially, Zelda was diagnosed with dry macular degeneration, and she experienced only minor vision loss in one eye. 3 years later, Zelda was at a local conference. As she looked over the presentation schedule posted on a board in the lobby, she reached up and rubbed one eye. To Zelda's shock, the presentation schedule disappeared. She went immediately to her doctor and discovered she had developed wet macular degeneration. Like Zelda, Grace Olson also experienced macular degeneration as a sudden, unexpected shock. Shock is not just surprise. Feeling shocked can be traumatic itself, above and beyond the actual life change or loss we sustain from the event that shocked us. When we are shocked by a sudden, life-threatening or life-changing event, we are more than surprised by something negative. We are hit with a feeling of powerlessness to stop what is happening to us. To a large degree, our sense of security in the world is predicated on our faith that we can determine our present and our future and that we have options. Of course we can and we do, but shock throws that faith into question. Feeling shocked without hearing about options and paths for action can exacerbate both the shock and the original problem, eventually contributing to depression. To counter shock, it's very important to seek support and visual rehabilitation as soon as you find out about your condition. Unfortunately, many people who have macular degeneration aren't told about resources and rehabilitation programs in their area. They may have received little attention when they were diagnosed. This was Grace Olson's experience. If this was your experience, too, it's never too late. Seek support now. See Appendix A to find a visual rehabilitation program in your area. Like Grace, you may still have residual feelings of shock. You may wonder why it happened the way it did. It happened in the summer of 1997. In June, I bought a beautiful gray Lincoln my husband would have loved. It reminded me so much of him. I drove myself up to Traverse City for the 4th of July. The humidity was terrible, and the road signs seemed so far away, as if I were looking at them through smoke. I thought it was the heat, waves of hot air rising from the cement. I remembered singing "Fly Me to the Moon" and squinting at road signs. At lunch that Sunday, my sister-in-law, Edie, leaned into my ear. "Pass the salt," she whispered loudly. "It's right there. What's the matter with you?" I never liked Edie. She's so abrupt. But the salt was sitting right in front of me. Plain as day, I just didn't see it. When I drove home, I noticed that the road signs still seemed hazy. I kept thinking, I must get new glasses. So I went to my ophthalmologist the very next week. "You have to see a retinal specialist," he said. He didn't sound urgent, just very matter-of-fact. The next Tuesday at 9 a.m., I went to see the retinal specialist. "Well," he said, all upbeat, "you've got macular degeneration. You have some irreversible vision loss, but most importantly, you need laser surgery right now to prevent additional loss. Can someone else drive you home?" I just stared at him. "What?" was all I could say. I felt like I was hearing him through 12 feet of water. He kept talking, but I don't think I heard a word he said after irreversible vision loss. My mind just froze on those words. I was so shocked. After laser surgery, I think my vision was actually worse in my left eye. Several days later, I saw the specialist again. He seemed pleased. "They're fine," he announced. "I think we've got it checked." "Checked?" I said. "What about my vision? What happened to my vision?" He didn't seem concerned. "That's to be expected," he said. "Hopefully, you'll still keep some of your vision this way. Just stop driving. You won't go blind from this, so you'll be okay." He patted me on the arm and out he went. Just like that. Just like he was telling me Hudson's department store was having a summer sale on whites. With that much feeling. But how am I going to be okay if I stop driving? I live in the Metro Detroit area. You can't do anything without driving. All my friends live off different freeway exits. Do you realize that I'd have to walk 2 miles on roads without sidewalks where people are driving 45 miles an hour and cross 2 6-lane intersections in order to get a carton of milk? How could he tell me I'm going to be fine and just walk out? How could he? Shooting the messenger? Not everyone has Grace's experience. Many people feel very supported and encouraged by their doctors, especially when their doctors give them information about visual rehabilitation and support groups. But many people do have Grace's experience. When Adina Williams, a polite, petite woman in her 80s, heard Grace's story, she said, "Yep, I know what she's talking about. I tell you, if I could drive my car just one more time, I'd use it to run my doctor over." General Dolly Kowalski, of all people, agreed, except that she recollected a shotgun her mother once used on a troublesome man back in 1922 on their farm in rural Indiana. It was very effective. Zelda Grant had another idea. Quote, "I'd give him macular degeneration for just 1 week and see whether he still wants to compare it to the challenges of handling age-related hair loss," end quote. What's going on here to provoke this private backlash in so many people? Is it a case of shooting the messenger? No one wants to hear that they have AMD or irreversible vision loss, but that's not what sets Dolly to thinking about her mother's shotgun. There are actually two problems at hand. The first is a communication problem. While most doctors went into the field because they care about people and they work very hard to fix their patients' medical conditions, that doesn't mean they know how to communicate effectively. The second problem is one of omission. Too many eye doctors are unaware of the existence of visual rehabilitation and their patients' need for it. They do not realize that they are actually failing to uphold the Hippocratic oath to do no harm when they say, "There's nothing that can be done," and walk out of the room without making any referrals or providing information. A neurologist wouldn't dream of walking away from a patient who could no longer use an arm as a result of a stroke without referring him or her to occupational therapy. So why do some eye doctors leave the room without saying a word? Why doctors can be abrupt. In most medical programs, doctors are trained under very stressful work conditions with long hours and little consideration for their own physical, emotional, or personal lives. They must learn to ignore these things for themselves, focus on problem solving, and move quickly. Their achievements are measured by how well they fixed the physical problem they were trained to fix, not by how well they related to their patients or by how well they understand the implications of the problem for their patients' lives. When doctors are faced with a problem that they cannot really fix, like macular degeneration, they are faced with their own limitations, and they don't always know how to handle it sensitively. As a matter of fact, doctors are, by far, my worst patients at our low vision rehabilitation program. Although this information may not be particularly comforting, you can rest assured that the more abrupt doctors are, the less likely they are to handle vision loss well if it happens to them. Doctors' take charge attitude often runs them right into the ground when they get macular degeneration. They have feared vision loss and fought it all their lives by seeking to control it. As you know better than anyone, if there's one thing that macular degeneration takes away from us, it's the ability to conquer by controlling. The people who handle AMD successfully are not the hard-charging executives or the general Patton types. They're the folks with a sense of humor, an abiding faith, and an ability to see the humanity in themselves and others regardless of their vision. They're the folks with a willingness to be flexible, to find other ways to direct their lives rather than by demanding precision and efficiency from everyone and everything around them. Doctors who communicate well and offer their patients empathy, guidance, and options had to learn how to do that on their own, or were lucky enough to have supportive mentors. This is true even in specialties that often deal with death or conditions that bring major life changes. 12 years ago, my mother was admitted to a hospital near my parents' home with minor chest pain. The staff assured us that she was fine, but she stayed overnight for tests. Sometime in the early morning, she suffered a massive heart attack. My father and I waited anxiously at the hospital for news. Eventually, a senior resident came out, stiffened, and blurted, "The code blue was unsuccessful." My father nodded gravely, stood up, and said, "Well, is she awake now? When can I see her?" The young doctor looked stunned. He had no idea what to say next. He had no idea how to tell my father that his beloved wife of 53 years had just died. He had used the only language he was taught, which is what many doctors do. Your doctor should refer you to visual rehabilitation. Family practitioners often don't refer their patients to visual rehabilitation because they assume the ophthalmologist will do it. After all, macular degeneration is an eye condition. But many ophthalmologists are not familiar with programs in their area. They may not even realize such programs exist, since visual rehabilitation is not a standard part of ophthalmology training, and the field is so new in medicine. Until recently, visual rehabilitation programs were designed almost exclusively for fully blind children or young adults. There were very few programs that addressed the needs and skills of seniors with partial vision loss. That's changing. Today, Medicare covers visual rehabilitation for macular degeneration in all 50 states, and we look forward to new programs developing in the near future. State commissions for the blind are revising their program offerings to include seniors. Visual rehabilitation programs are opening their doors around the country, and occupational therapy schools are realizing that we need occupational therapists who can work with people who have macular degeneration too. There's a great effort nationwide to educate doctors about these programs and the importance of visual rehabilitation. Until the word is out, though, you may have to take matters into your own hands. To find rehabilitation programs in your area, follow the guide in Appendix A. Keep in mind that programs vary in quality and scope, so it's best to check out all your options. In some areas of the country, programs are not covered by insurance or are not available. This was one of the biggest reasons that we wrote this book, so that it could serve as your own personal visual rehabilitation program or as a supplement to one in your area. In Part 3 of this book, you'll find a complete home version of our program here in Michigan. The importance of early visual rehabilitation. The time to start visual rehabilitation is now, as soon as you begin to experience any vision loss at all. Some programs will only accept participants with vision of 20/70 or less, or in some cases 20/200 or less in their better eye. But we know that the earlier you start visual rehabilitation, the better off you will be. This does not mean giving up on your sight or future treatments. You can still focus on keeping your eyes healthy and learn the life-saving principles of visual rehabilitation at the same time. When it comes to living with macular degeneration, the more you know, the stronger you will be. If you do not qualify for a program in your area, you can still begin visual rehabilitation using Part 3 of this book. How shock interrupts understanding. Often when doctors do talk, we can't hear them. Justice Grace said that she didn't hear anything her doctor said after he told her she had irreversible vision loss. It's often difficult for anyone to assimilate anything said after a shock. Our minds protect us emotionally by tuning out information that overwhelms us. Sometimes we don't even realize we've tuned out. We just don't remember that anything was said. I often find myself repeating information upon request, knowing that it's natural for people to have difficulty digesting it all at once. It's also easy to forget questions while you're at your doctor's office. Try the following 5 tips for talking with your doctor and getting the most out of your appointment. 5 tips for talking with your doctor. 1. Brainstorm your questions before your appointment. Write them down with a black felt-tip pen and take them with you. 2. Take a friend or family member along so there are 2 sets of ears listening in the room. 3. If your doctor's explanations aren't easily understandable, ask for an assistant in the office who can explain in clear detail and answer questions. 4. Ask your doctor for a referral to a rehabilitation program and support group in your area. 5. Don't take it personally if your doctor isn't supportive or seems rushed. It is not a reflection of your condition or your potential. Beyond shock, Zelda's and Sam's experiences. Just as people have different experiences of vision loss with macular degeneration, they also have different experiences of coping. We left Grace at a moment of crisis. After her diagnosis, she felt so overwhelmed with the enormity of losing her driver's license, with fears of blindness, and with the absence of information or assistance, that she struggled with depression for 2 years. Grace's depression lifted when she moved to a socially active senior community, came to visual rehabilitation, received some counseling, and joined a support group. For a time, macular degeneration took my life away, Grace reflected. Now I've started a new one. As Judy Prevost puts in her online memoir, quote, macular degeneration can either hurl us into an unforgiving depression or teach us new ways of seeing and feeling that we have never experienced before, end quote. Like Grace, Zelda Grant faced shock. But Zelda's fiery personality and her doctor's support made the experience different for her. Sam Weinberg, however, never really felt shocked. He was diagnosed with dry macular degeneration 15 years ago, and his vision loss progressed very slowly, giving Sam plenty of time to adjust. Macular degeneration has, however, caused Sam to question his approach to life. He has worked to cultivate his sense of humor, which has helped him adjust to macular degeneration. Zelda Grant's story. The day my doctor told me that I had low vision from macular degeneration, I came home and smashed every dish in the house, all 12 plate settings, 2 platters, and a cake plate. They were white china with little blue flowers that looked like little squiggly bugs to me. At the time, I was crying and screaming and smashing. There were chips everywhere. The kitchen floor was a mess. When I was done, all I had left were a half dozen navy blue plastic bowls and a few coffee mugs. But I saved my life. If I hadn't smashed those dishes, I'd be an angry woman with a pretty dining room setting that I couldn't really see anyway. I was angry for a long time as it was, and I sometimes still am. But smashing those dishes was a turning point, a declaration. I am going to live, and worrying about little blue flower bugs on my plates is not a part of living anymore. Besides, if I hadn't smashed those plates, it never would have occurred to me to get brightly colored plastic daily dishes that are easier to see and harder to break. The navy blue bowls gave me that idea. On a white tablecloth, they are much more visible than white china ever could be. So, after I cleaned up my kitchen, I went through the information packet my doctor gave me and began to make some phone calls. I called a rehabilitation program in my area, and I said, "Hello, my name is Zelda Grant. I want an appointment, and I want to know how I am going to keep reading." And then I called the neighborhood community center and said, "Hello, my name is Zelda Grant. I have low vision, and I think I have a lot of energy. I need an exercise class." And then I called the support group listed in my information packet, and I said, "Hello, my name is Zelda Grant. What do you people talk about anyway?" I didn't bank on much to start with, but the more calls I made and the more people I talked to, the easier it was to get help and to do the things I wanted to do. You know, there are many people with inspiring approaches to life. I recently heard a quote from a paraplegic man named Mark Wellman, who climbed a mountain at Yosemite National Park. Can you imagine climbing a mountain without using your legs? He says, "You have a dream, and you know the only way that dream is going to happen is if you do it, even if it's 6 inches at a time." Now, that's even a little much for me. I have a simpler motto. I just say, no matter who you are, if you stop trying, you're dead. You just forgot to lie down. Sam Weinberg's story. I first learned I had dry macular degeneration 15 years ago. My doctor said, "Sam, you've got drusen here, but just a very slight amount of vision loss." I immediately thought, "My God, what's going to happen to my law practice? I have a small town private practice, mostly estate planning and compensation. I really worried that as soon as everyone knew, they'd decide they didn't want a visually impaired attorney. So I did everything I could to camouflage my low vision. I didn't even tell Rachel initially. I pretended I could see everything. I stayed up late at night using a magnifier and a bright desk lamp to read small print documents and memorize them so I could quote them verbatim and I wouldn't have to refer to papers during meetings. When new clients came, I called my secretary into the office and asked her to take detailed notes, type them, and print them in large font, so I wouldn't have to take notes myself. I stopped trying to read tiny price labels at the grocery store. I just took a lot of money with me and paid whatever the total came out to be. Rachel got suspicious pretty quickly. One day she eyed me and said, "You used to love coupons. What happened?" After a few years, I just couldn't keep it a secret any longer, especially when my vision got worse. Rachel said, "Sam, they know you. They know you're a good lawyer. You're still a good lawyer." I didn't believe her at first, but she was right. My regular clients have been really loyal. They consult with me about ongoing issues and bring me new cases. I also do a fair amount of consulting to younger attorneys, especially in the compensation field. Since I know so much at this point, I work 40 hours a week. And I spend a lot of time reading relevant journals and keeping up on the field. I have CCTVs, or closed-circuit TVs, for my office and my home. I have a big print software for my computer and a large monitor. I use tape recorders for important meetings and depositions. I use floodlights in my office, and I write everything with black felt-tip pens. My secretary has gotten really adept at a low-vision legal practice. Sometimes I think Rachel would prefer if I weren't working so hard. Actually, I've been thinking about cutting back because I'd like to spend more time with my violin. When I was young, I wanted to be a professional musician, but it didn't seem financially feasible. I figure, now is my chance to play all the time. Low vision has challenged me to be less earnest. I'm an overachiever and that's gotten me far in life. But sometimes I forget to have a good time. So I've really tried to strengthen my sense of humor and not take it all too seriously. Rachel keeps me on my toes. We went to a big party last week. Rachel wore a pair of distinctly black and white patent leather shoes. She disappeared into the crowd, so I went looking for her shoes. When I thought I'd found them, I leaned over, puckered up, and whispered, "Are you my wife?" This woman jumped 6 feet and huffed, "I certainly hope not." "Too bad," I said. "You don't know what you're missing." At the same party, I ate dry cat food. It was sitting in a bowl on the kitchen counter, looking just like mixed nuts and pretzels. Rachel said, "Sam, what am I going to do with you?" And we laughed so hard we had tears in our eyes. Chapter 6. With the heart one sees rightly. Living fully with AMD. It is with the heart that one sees rightly. What is essential is invisible to the eye. A quote from Antoine de Saint-Exupéry from The Little Prince. I have met many people in the last few years whose courage matches their despair, whose hearts are still hopeful, people who are both defiant and defeated, angry and optimistic, fearful and faithful. As Betty Davis put it, growing old ain't for sissies, and neither is macular degeneration. But seniors are hardly sissies. If you are in your 90s, by the time you were half your age, you had experienced 2 world wars and the greatest depression in the history of this country. If you were in your 80s, you may barely remember World War I, but you spent your teen years during the depression and your young adulthood in World War II. If you are in your 70s, you missed World War I entirely and you just made World War II, and then you got to send your son to Vietnam. You grew up without Social Security, penicillin, civil rights movement, Title IX, Alcoholics Anonymous, Dr. Spock, and permanent press, and that's not easy. If you are in your 60s and have just discovered on the eve of your retirement that you are losing your vision, with 20 or 30 years of living ahead of you, that's not easy either. You have probably already experienced profound losses in your life, but losing vision is a new kind of loss. Unlike deaths, accidents, or serious illnesses, AMD comes quietly, often without public recognition, certainly without flowers or phone calls. It doesn't seem very dramatic until it happens to you. As Buddy Burmester said, you wouldn't believe how often you use your eyes every day for everything. But it's not just that I can't see what I want to see. It affects my sense of control over my life and my confidence with other people. It affects everything. I guess I assumed my eyes would always be there for me. Since vision loss is a new kind of loss, it raises new issues and requires new coping skills that may be unfamiliar to you. They include expressing your feelings, addressing depression, joining the macular degeneration community, exercising for better health, taking risks, and starting visual rehabilitation. Expressing your feelings. For many people, losing vision is like losing a loved one. You may have very strong feelings about your vision loss, feelings of anger, frustration, fear, regret, embarrassment, or grief. Vision loss deserves grieving and acknowledgement. You don't have to smash plates like Zelda Grant, but give yourself permission to feel strongly and permission to express your feelings. Expressing your feelings means identifying how you feel and sharing your feelings in all of their depth and richness with a friend, family member, religious advisor, or counselor. Some people even share their feelings with their pets. Others turn to a patron saint. Turn to someone with whom you feel comfortable, someone who will listen supportively and acknowledge your feelings. Just as there are many different people to whom you may turn, There are also many different ways of expressing your feelings. Expressing your feelings may mean crying, screaming, whispering, writing, dancing, walking, just plain old talking, or punching a pillow. Expressing your feelings may also be a process that unfolds over time and through many conversations. Zelda didn't accept having low vision in one afternoon. I doubt anyone does. Whatever you do, though, don't bottle yourself up and tell yourself that there's no reason to have feelings at all. Express your feelings may be advice that makes sense to you, but it may not. If you are over 65, you were probably raised to be polite and to keep private matters private. Women in senior generations were taught to make others comfortable whenever possible. Men were taught that feelings are a sign of weakness. And everyone was taught to get tough and pull themselves up by the bootstraps. Feelings weren't even really a topic of public conversation until the baby boomers became the me generation. Before 1965, feelings were things you had about your first crush. Having too many of them wasn't generally considered a good idea. They might get in the way of meeting your responsibilities at work or at home. But the fact that you don't show your feelings doesn't mean you don't have them. And if you don't acknowledge them, they may weigh heavily on you, or they may erupt in other areas of your life. Or you may spend so much energy keeping them in check that you aren't really free to feel fully alive or face the future. Pulling yourself up by the bootstraps. So, does expressing your feelings mean you shouldn't pull yourself up by the bootstraps? Is bootstrapping a thing of the past? Absolutely not. It's still a good thing. But today's bootstrapping is different from yesterday's. Pulling yourself up by the bootstraps used to mean doing it all alone. It used to mean having as few needs and as few feelings as possible. It used to mean being carefully dignified and keeping a stiff upper lip. It used to mean saving your money to buy white gloves for Sundays or for shopping downtown. But the world has changed in the last 35 years. Now we wear sweatpants to the airport, and the doctor's office, neighbors, and friends talk openly about coping with breast cancer or alcoholism, and strangers reveal their private lives on national television. As a society, we've taken off the white gloves, but as individuals, we often keep them close at hand. We still cling to the idea that coping well means being quiet, and dignity means doing things properly the first time. But that's not true, and it's an idea that isn't doing us any favors. Redefining bootstrapping. Zelda Grant was bootstrapping when she had a screaming fit in her kitchen and smashed all her plates. She was bootstrapping when she called for a visual rehabilitation appointment and when she called her neighborhood club to enroll in an exercise class. And she was bootstrapping when she called her local low-vision support group and said, "Hello, my name is Zelda Grant. What do people talk about anyway?" She may not be winning any points for tact or diplomacy, but as a bootstrapper, she's a champion. Bootstrapping today means having feelings, figuring out what they are and expressing them. Bootstrapping today means having needs, figuring out what they are and getting them met. Bootstrapping today means asking for the support you need and learning the skills that will enable you to do as much as you can. Most important, though, bootstrapping today means putting the white gloves away. It means taking the risk that you won't do it properly the first time, that you won't avoid every spill, that you won't always look absolutely perfect, and it means realizing that that's okay. Bootstrapping means putting on your finest clothes for a dinner party and chuckling when you realize you've served paper towels in the tossed salad. Because the truth is that nobody really minds. People like you for you, not for what you can see. Bootstrapping means enjoying their company and realizing that the greatest dignity of all comes from just living. Depression and AMD. Many people who lose vision go through a short period of mild depression as they grieve their loss and adjust their lives. But many others experience prolonged periods of depression that are unhealthy for the body and spirit. We know a great deal more about depression than we did 20 or 30 years ago. We know that it's not a sign of weakness, laziness, or moral failure. We know that depression happens to people who have no other psychological difficulties. We know that depression can happen to you later in life, even if you've never been depressed before. And we know that depression is very common among people with low vision. There is nothing shameful about it, but there is something very tragic about living with depression without getting help. Common symptoms of depression. Consider the following list and ask yourself whether or not any of these symptoms are familiar. Frequently feeling apathetic or unmotivated. Frequently feeling agitated, empty, or numb. Frequently feeling pessimistic or negative about yourself. Withdrawing socially. Insomnia or hypersomnia, parentheses, sleeping too little or too much, end of parentheses. Losing or gaining more than 5% of your body weight in a month. Noticeable decrease in energy. Unexplained episodes of crying, emotional swings, or outbursts. Frequently focusing on regrets. What causes depression with macular degeneration? Depression with macular degeneration may arise from deep feelings of rage, grief, frustration, loneliness, from prolonged inactivity or boredom, from losing faith or hope, from self-judgment, fearing the future, or feeling out of control. One of the strongest findings about depression with macular degeneration, strangely enough, is that it is not related to the amount of vision you lose. There are people with very mild vision loss who experience very serious depression, and people with very serious vision loss who experience little depression at all. Why? It turns out that whether or not you experience depression depends on a number of factors that are unique to each of us. Some people are genetically predisposed to depression. Your diet and exercise patterns also make a difference, especially if you are sensitive to sugar or alcohol. Function is a huge factor. The more you are able to do with low vision, the less likely you are to become depressed or stay depressed. That's one of the reasons that visual rehabilitation is so important. The good news about rehabilitation is that what you can do is not necessarily determined by how much you can see. As counterintuitive as this sounds, yes, you may not be able to do everything, or even many things, the same way, but there are almost always alternatives. Seeking alternatives is a powerful antidote to depression, the wooden stake to its Draculean presence. The earlier and more assertively you seek alternatives for doing the things you'd like to do, the narrower the window of opportunity long-term depression has to take hold. This is the end of side 4, continued on side 5.